we've seen now in the last 10 years with cyber is they're becoming way more organized. And especially in the early days, the number one question concern was, if we pay, are we going to get our decryption key? You could easily make the argument that I'm not going to pay because I have no idea that if you're going to honor our agreement. It's out there. And there are those moments when it's out there and you're like, oh my God, it's been 2 hours. I haven't heard back. Did we just get ripped off? There's always going to be advances in technology that criminals are the first to adopt. That's the way it's always been. So you can't fix ransomware by attacking the internet or by attacking Bitcoin. That doesn't solve the problem.
How do organized cyber threat groups work? What's their motivation? And who's at risk? This is the Cyber Crime Lab, a podcast about true cybercrime stories, the impact on victims, and what businesses can do to protect themselves and their customers. And if you think you're not at risk, that is exactly where attackers want you to be. Like so many of our guests, Vincent got his start in the FBI. Today, he is the head of Cyber Forensics Incident Response at Blue Voyant. He worked at the helm of defense for many different cyber attacks and has several stories to tell.
For those who don't know your background, would love for you to kind of give a quick introduction for some of the stuff that you've been up to in the last couple of years.
Yeah. So again, Vinny D'Agostino, I'm currently head of Cyber Forensics Incident Response at Blue Voyant, which is a cyber security company that was founded in 2017. I'm one of the original founding members of that company that provides a whole host of services like managed security services and third-party risk and proactive services and digital rights protections. And my team that I run is the incident response team. So all we do is breach response, which run the gamut from, you know, your business email compromise to your insider threat cases to, of course, ransomware cases, which have occupied the majority of our time in the last probably 4 years, just because of how big of a threat and how devastating those attacks are, how they become. Prior to that, I was over at the FBI. I was a special agent there for 11 years, finished my career in the cyber division, although I did work Italian organized crime for my first 7 or 8 years. Which we were kind of talking about before the show started, the similarities that I'm starting to see emerge between these ransomware groups and traditional organized crime are undoubtedly becoming more pronounced. And then before going to the FBI, I was a lawyer, practicing lawyer here in New York. And as kind of a hobby, I was a network system administrator and just cyber geek since I was probably 7 years old. So that's me in a nutshell.
No, that's awesome. Yeah. And I think so fun, your background in a mix of kind of, you know, being able to put actual experience with organized crime and some of the technical stuff into one role, I'm sure. Pretty fun. This may be a little bit different than some of our other episodes because you've just had such an extensive experience looking at these types of organizations. And so I'd love if we just took some time and talked about what it's like, you know, how you see these organizations for those who don't encounter them with the frequency that you do. You know, who's on the other side of these ransomware demands? Who's kind of propagating these types of incidents? How do you think about them? How do you study them? What's all the weird and strange things that, you know, people wouldn't realize if they didn't deal with them every day?
Yeah, or the things that if they realize would probably just disconnect the internet from their house altogether and leave it at that.
How would I get food or anything?
No, else? I know. We're totally addicted. We're hooked. It doesn't matter how bad it gets. It's not a matter. No one's ever going back. That's for sure. But no, the groups themselves, I think the big change from when, you know, when I originally went over to the government, I came in under the law and cyber program, and people always say, well, why didn't you go into cyber right out of the gate? And I was really more interested in organized crime. It was kind of like the main reason being is that the idea of going up against adversaries that are very highly organized and there's a history there and there are rules, I think was very appealing to me because it seemed like a really worthwhile effort. And cyber at that time was all over the place still. It was still in its infancy. I mean, you're talking about copyright infringement cases, a lot of child porn cases, and a handful of like hacks. I'm talking about 2004 or so, like comparatively speaking in its infancy. I mean, way less mature of a violation. In fact, things like child porn aren't even under cyber division anymore. at the Bureau because they really have nothing to do with cyber. It's just a computer helping to facilitate a traditional crime, but that doesn't make it cyber. But the reason I mention that is because the organized crime aspect of investigating crimes is really interesting and complicated and high stakes. And what we've seen now in the last 10 years with cyber is they're becoming way more organized. The distinction between the two, I don't really see as much anymore as it used to. In the beginning, it was like lone, this guy's a hacker and he's got a couple of hacker friends and maybe they go do something, but they don't have like a brand. They don't have like a website. You know, they don't have a name and shame website. They're not making $200 million a year openly out in the open, and not only openly doing it, but bragging about it. And with these ransomware gangs that have evolved over the last 5 or 6 years, that's what we're seeing now is they're dealing with the same issues that Italian organized crime is dealing with in terms of growing a criminal enterprise while simultaneously dealing with the complexities of being a cyber startup, which I find hysterical. And that's kind of what I've been noticing over the last few years.
Threat actors are slowly but surely becoming more and more like a regular organized crime group. At the same time, they are also becoming more and more sophisticated and something all their own. Listen closely to how Andy describes their evolution.
Yeah, no, I was lucky enough in college actually to take a class on organized crime, and it was fascinating, right? And the high level story, which you know very, very well, is basically organized crime, you know, governs any space that the government refuses to regulate.
Yeah.
Right. And it does it with its own rules and its own kind of sets of practices, right? But that same level of thought and effort that's going into kind of the legal side of the world is often happening there as well. But yeah, fascinating. When you think about what you're seeing from these, like, walk me through kind of like where they are, who they are, what they're, you know, to the extent that you know, right? And there was this really interesting treasure trove of leaks that happened in the last several months with Conti. Maybe walk people through kind of why that got dumped and then what we learned out of that.
So what is Conti? You'll notice that Andy and Vincent refer to it a lot in this conversation, as it has been in the public eye recently. Conti is a ransomware that is believed to be distributed by a threat actor group based in Russia. The U.S. government currently has a reward of up to $10 million for any information on the group.
Yeah, I was doing a show earlier today on that very subject, on the Conti leaks and what the impact of that is. And there's a downside to being very public. And when you're asking the question who they are, there's a real benefit if you're a threat actor, especially if you're participating in ransomware, with being anonymous in terms of where your country of origin is. And the reason is there are rules, as you just said, about government regulation, about entities, organizations, individuals, countries that U.S. citizens can't pay, because the Department of Treasury has rules that say, and OFAC says, hey, you can't pay Iran, you can't pay Russia. If these are sanctioned nations, you can't pay them. And so there's dozens and dozens of ransomware groups out there. And that's because they're, you know, like these affiliates that kind of fall out from under the main groups. But when Russia invaded the Ukraine, Conti came out very much in favor of Russia and supporting Russia and basically saying anyone who attacks Russia, we're going to attack them. But the problem with that is that very quickly made it so that they ended up on the no pay list, essentially. Nobody could pay them. And so a complete blunder on their part. And because of that, the number of attacks that are successful attacks, they could gain access, they could encrypt your data. But if a victim is telling them, I would love to pay you, but I just can't because we'll go to jail, that's kind of a hard thing as a threat actor to say, pay us anyway. Like, no one's going to do that. So they've had to really, really decide what to do in the face of that. And not only externally, but internally, they pissed off some of their members of their group. And they had one individual who I don't think was a member of a group. I think he was a Ukrainian researcher, I think.
Contractor
or something. He was able to gain access to some of Conti's infrastructure and exfiltrate a ton of their chats and their logs. I mean, this would be like somebody stealing your company's Slack conversations and then dumping them on the surface web. So over the last month or so, myself and many other nerds have been kind of going through that and talking about some of the findings based on their inside communications, which is really embarrassing for them, of course, and has forced them to have to further redefined. And there's even some theories that Conti as a brand is just dead. And I read an article over the weekend from another company that's theorizing that they believe the Conti name will no, be no longer, and it'll just, you know, change into something else. Conti came from Ryuk, really. The connections between Ryuk ransomware and Conti are pretty clear. So they might rebrand, but it's weird to talk about that, right? Those are things that, you know, the Gambino family didn't have to rebrand themselves every 5 years and say, you know, now we're the Gambino 2 family. Now we're the Colombo family. They didn't have to do that. But these groups, because of how they're operating and the rules around who you can pay and who you can't, actually have to deal with that problem.
It's sort of a fascinating, on so many layers, right? So one, you had, what's happening in Ukraine, and the Russian and Ukrainian sort of criminal syndicates were collaborating prior to this invasion, right? Like, I mean, historically, mm-hmm. those two countries were just very, very close geographically, literally, you know, the familial ties between the two countries are extensive. And so just the way they were collaborating, they were families and businesses working together. Now you've sort of seen that. And so in some ways, Conti was, when you started a war, you also severed some of those yep. ties. And again, there's something really interesting happening where the sort of non-government individuals are getting involved in attacking Russian infrastructure, and you're seeing it sort of splashing into the criminal side of this as well. So fascinating there. Yeah, I mean, I think this idea of branding and having to, you know, think about the perceptions of how an individual syndicate is perceived and used, right? Because, you know, for people who aren't as aware, they're literally packaging exploits and ways to get in, and then they're maybe selling that or loaning that to their affiliates, right? And so having a strong brand is really valuable, right? It's a quality product, right?
Well, yeah, because from the negotiation side of it, and especially in the early days, the number one question concern was, if we pay, are we going to get our decryption key? This was before the double extortion, when it was just simply a matter of encryption. When I was at the Bureau's stance initially was, don't pay because you don't know if you're going to get the decryption key. And that's fair, except when, let's say, 6 months goes by and 100 companies, 200 companies make a payment and 99.9% of them get a decryption key, then it's hard to say, oh, just don't pay them because you're going to get ripped off. And then, of course, with the, you know, the advent of the double extortion, one being you're paying for a decryption key, and then two, you're paying for the destruction of the data, many companies find themselves in the position to say, oh, we have backups, we don't need to pay. And then you say, but okay, there's all this other data now that's out there. There's half a terabyte of HR data. There's half a terabyte of private healthcare information out there. And, you know, there's probably a number that's going to make it worthwhile for them. But having a brand like saying, this is Conti, you have our word, look at our reputation. I've been told that in chats for various groups. Maybe you don't know about such and such group, you know, they're pounding their chest. Maybe you haven't heard about blah, blah, blah. That's not how we operate, and we guarantee this and blah, blah, blah. And when the research corroborates that, that's the power of a brand. That say, so, all right, you don't believe the bad guy telling you, but if you turn to a company like Bluevoin, you turn to me, you turn to companies that do negotiations, and you say, so what is your data showing you? And they go, yeah, it's 98, 99% with this group. There's the brand. That's the value of the brand, as opposed to Joe Schmo brand, where you could easily make the argument that I'm not going to pay because I have no idea that if you're going to honor our agreement, because you're transmitting the Bitcoin first. I mean, obviously, you know, so it's out there, and there are those moments when it's out there and you're like, oh my God, it's been 2 hours. I haven't heard back. Did we just get ripped off? That happens. But if it happened more often, people just would stop paying. Word would get out.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's fascinating, right? And when you understand that this is a market that was unregulated, right? Because it's, you know, it's criminal, right? But actually providing the mechanisms of that market, and that they have to work in every market, like trust, mm-hmm. are really important, right? Because it's, if you don't have that trust, you can't literally exchange things, even if they're criminal in nature. It's kind of fascinating in a sad way, obviously, because it's costing people a lot of money, but really understandable how it it helps you understand what's going on. You know, I'm sure that you're reading about when different organizations get taken down and the individuals get arrested. You know, who do these people tend to be? What does it look like? What are the history of them? What's the structure of them? All of those sorts of things.
Learning more about what criminal groups are about is essential for investigators like Vincent, but bad for threat actors. That's why many have to go through the rebranding process that both Andy and Vincent have mentioned.
I mean, 90% of them are from New Jersey, so if you didn't have enough of reason. So Russia and Ukraine definitely make up a large portion, but you know, there were takedowns. I think Ryuk did have a takedown pre-invasion out in Russia. So you got to remember, the people doing this, the risks are high because if they get caught, they're going to probably go to jail for forever, if not forever, for many, many decades, for most of the, because the scale of these crimes, right? This is the impact that I think people struggle with the Silk Road verdict and Ulbricht is they lose sense of the proportionality of the crime.
Let's pause to explain the Silk Road verdict. Silk Road was an underground website where users could purchase illegal drugs. The mastermind behind the site, Ross Ulbricht, was caught and prosecuted in 2017 and was sentenced to life in prison. The case was highly publicized.
Somebody selling drugs out of their house can only grow so big in a year or two and only commit so many violations of law in a year or two. Somebody doing that from the dark web to the tune of $2 billion in 2 years reaches a lot more people, and therefore the punishment by how our laws work. And so people committing these ransomware attacks are committing dozens and dozens of violations of federal law. So if they're caught, they're going away for a very, very long time. This isn't the equivalent of beating up somebody and taking their money, or even extorting a restaurant. You know, the time you're going to do for a wise guy would do for extorting, shaking down a restaurant for protection money, times that by 2,000. That would be the equivalent. So my point in mentioning that is, so these people are operating in countries that are typically non-extradition countries, and they're attacking countries that are non-friendly for a couple of different reasons. So if you're living in Russia, your government stance on you taking down American companies is likely going to simply be, just give us our piece of whatever you're taking. That's probably the way that functions. It's not going to be, oh my God, America, we love them so much. You know, you can't, no, of course not. And so the odds of ever catching these people, it becomes very difficult from a law enforcement perspective to find these people. Oddly enough, there was a woman recently arrested in relation to some type of key support role in the functionality of TrickBot, which Conti relies on. And she lives in Florida. And there were discussions in those leaks, in those chats, about Conti paying for her lawyer, which again, is very common in traditional organized crime, that if somebody gets arrested, not because of the kindness of your heart, usually because you're hoping that they don't cooperate. And if they do, you want to know that they're cooperating. So you pay for their lawyer, because now their lawyer is conflicted, because the person paying the bill is, by the rules of ethics, the lawyer isn't supposed to say those things, but that's exactly what happens with mob lawyers. And so they have this woman now who's been arrested in Florida, is being prosecuted, who has some intimate information about TrickBot, and ostensibly that would extend to the Conti organization itself. So not that there's people not in the United States or in Europe that aren't facilitating. My belief has always been that the people who are assisting these ransomware groups from these countries that we would consider friendly are assisting in a way that there's very much minimized risk. Their role is much smaller. So maybe they do gain access into a network and they're selling that access to someone else who then sells it again to Conti. And they're like, hey, I made $10,000. All I had to do was get local admin access on a domain controller, and I stopped touching anything. And then I just sold that to somebody else. And the odds of it ever getting back to me are so nebulous that I can live with that. Whereas I think you go to these countries that are non-extradition and they're completely other side of the spectrum. You know, they're the ones actually doing the negotiations. They're the ones cashing out the Bitcoin. They're the ones maintaining the TrickBot network so it can be used to gain access in the first place and exploit that access. So their level of involvement is just much, much deeper. I think the more of an unfriendly nation you find, that's where you're going to find more of these threat actors living.
As you've seen this, you know, this sort of space mature and these organizations become more sophisticated, and understandably, the money is stunning, right? You know, like the profit on a pure, whether you measure it on a pure dollars number or just on a percentage, either way, is just sort of stunning. And you sort of understand why individuals are involved in it. I mean, they're making hundreds of thousands of percent profit and sometimes tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year, right? As an organization, probably not as individuals.
Conti, I think, not to cut you off, but I think their conservative estimates put them at about 180 million last year. So you're talking serious bucks.
That would put them pretty high on the startup kind of revenue.
Absolutely.
Stakes, right?
Yep.
If we're measuring them there. You know, where do you think things are going? I mean, you've sort of seen this industry kind of grow up and mature. What's your expectation in terms of how things play out in the sort of cat and mouse game between law enforcement as you start to see private entities, even the financial industry, even the sort of more regulation around crypto, right? Because in some ways, ransomware has been a big consequence of the ability to transfer funds much more anonymously.
Yeah, in the same way that a car would be the consequence of facilitating bank robberies. Like, I think the technology, the underlying technology is just like, well, then let's backtrack it even more. Without the internet, ransomware doesn't exist. So we do have to understand that. And there are a lot of people that take the opportunity to highlight ransomware or even Tor hidden services or illicit websites, you know, oh, well, Bitcoin, it, you know, I think when we focus too much attention on that, we're kind of missing the big picture here. Is there's always going to be advances in technology that criminals are the first to adopt. That's the way it's always been. That's the way the Italian mafia is run, that when a phone comes out or a car comes out, those groups are saying, how can we use this car to commit crimes better and faster, way before a company like FedEx is saying, how can we use this to deliver packages better? And so I think that's going to be part of it. But as far as the regulation, and full disclosure, I got into Bitcoin very early on while I was at the FBI. And because of the nature of the cases I was investigating, I had to learn about it. I say had to, but it was more like I was convinced it was Bitcoin was some type of Ponzi scheme and there was some type of way to corrupt it so that the government could track it and could shut it down. And I learned very quickly that it was the exact opposite. And so I became a huge proponent. I began mining Bitcoin back in 2012 and became very heavily interested and remained heavily interested in Bitcoin since then because of what I realized it was and was not. And so the use of it, absolutely, kind of like going back to the Silk Road thing, is like, you know, you don't have a Silk Road without Bitcoin. You can't run Silk Road and get paid in phone cards for your heroin. It's not going to work. No one's going to subscribe to that model. Same thing for ransomware, right? The use of Bitcoin and other, not as nearly as common, but things like Monero are occasionally used, is definitely a part of that. But in terms of where it's going, there's not much the government can do. There's some legislation that's been proposed regarding like reporting and, okay, if you pay a ransomware payment, you have to disclose it. The thing is that, at least I'll speak from Bluevoin's perspective, we've leaned very heavily into sharing of intelligence and information related to these things. And we've always encouraged our clients to participate to the extent that it makes sense, which most of the time it does, to provide that information to law enforcement so that they can get a bigger picture. But with that said, it's not really it's of minimal use in the long run. So you can't fix ransomware by attacking the internet or by attacking Bitcoin. That doesn't solve the problem. You have to find other ways to attack it. So something that very interesting that came up that I think was is important is putting out bounties for information leading to the arrests or conviction of people involved is probably, in my opinion, a better use of a way to at least slow the growth of ransomware, more so than anything else. Flipping that on its head and saying, hey, rather than spend all this money on trying to chase down a Bitcoin withdrawal from an exchange a year from now, you know, maybe it's better to actually actively put out bounties for people leading for information, people involved in these things. But ransomware has slowed down this year. And I think a lot of that is because of the invasion into Ukraine and them being occupied with an actual kinetic war. But it's not going to go away. Ransomware is just too profitable for it not to go away. So the answer from when you say where is it going, it's sort of a loaded question because from the perspective of the government, from the perspective of law enforcement generally, from the perspective of companies, I think the answer for companies is pretty clear, which is that you have to understand how disruptive these types of attacks are to your organization. And if you're not investing resources proactively in defending yourself, you're going to find yourself meeting me and my team on a really bad day, having to make some really bad decisions that are no-win decisions for you and your company. And so the amount that you have to spend on an incident response compared to what you could spend proactively is day and night. And I think that's the biggest thing really since the Colonial Pipeline attack that's brought this to the forefront is a lot of companies are starting to get more serious about, okay, what does it look like to be, to improve our cyber defense posture? Does that mean some sort of MDR solution where you have an agent on all sensors on the network? That puts you in a really big place.
The Colonial Pipeline is an American pipeline system based in Texas that carries fuel and gasoline to the southeastern U.S. It underwent a ransomware attack in 2021. The hack was capable due to a lack of endpoint detection and response, or EDR.
I had a threat actor, and I will have to publish it one day. I had a threat actor in a chat. Lots of times you get into this dialogue with the threat actors about random stuff, and had some really weird conversations with Maze and a few other groups where they really get into their politics of behind what they're doing. And one of the conversations I had a few months ago with a group, I forget which group it was now, but the person said, oh, well, we got into your environment and your EDR was missing on this machine. So we went after that device. Had the EDR been on this machine, we wouldn't have been able to do this. I was like, oh, I got to make this like an advertisement for having an EDR MDR product on your network, like beyond just antivirus. I mean, an actual sensor that's being monitored 24/7 for suspicious activity. That's the way to go because these people linger in your environment for weeks usually before they do anything. And it's in that weeks of time where there's every opportunity for them to have gotten caught. And you may not be able to stop all of it, but when you're talking about mitigating the damage where they're only encrypting a portion of your network or even just one or two machine, it just completely changes the dynamic of the response. It goes from a catastrophic event to like, you know, who cares? Blow out the machine and rebuild it. Not a big deal.
Yeah. The fire that burned down the whole building versus, you know, we burned toast in one of the apartments.
Exactly. Right?
And, you know, we burned some hand towels and whatnot. And yeah, that place smells a little smoky.
Yeah. We'll be fine in a week from now. Open a windows, it'll air out.
Yeah, right. Open the windows. It'll air out. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to see, but I think we're definitely getting a sense of sort of progress. You know, even for those who've been in the space for a little while, you know, the different types of attacks that have rolled through. I mean, people still steal credit cards for sure, right? But it's not what we talk about every day, right? You know, and a lot, the banking industry has just gotten much better in terms of fraud detection. And so,
yep.
You know, within minutes, I've compromised card gets sort of stopped and, you know, and you look for these choke points, which I think are really interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, your view, your perspective on bounties, right? And probably the use of criminal informants and the success that law enforcement has in using them and their power of, in so many cases, I'm sure you bring more perspective than many in terms of how key they are to really, you know.
Yeah, I mean, again, going back to the most successful organized crime prosecutions you could think of, even people that are casual fans of organized crime will say Sammy the Bull. They'll be able to point out the cooperators, the people who did the most damage are the ones that did it from the inside in. That's how we made our cases, was it was flipping members and using those members to get charges on someone who's higher within the organization, and then flipping that person, cooperating them, making them make recordings for another 2 years, and then flipping that person based on that recording until eventually you get somebody that is so high up that they can take down, you know, most of the organization with the credibility of someone who should have been in the know, somebody who was not a guy who showed up to a card game, who's claiming he can outline how the Colombo family operates. No one's going to believe that person, but a guy who's a made member, a guy who's a captain or in the administration. So similar. And that's also, again, going back to some of those tour cases, the hard part is finding them. And the cyber aspect, it's very difficult to find who these people are in real life. But if you're offering out bounties, then the odds of somebody coming forward that actually may have the information you're looking for and was intimately involved, I think go up dramatically. Otherwise, you're just relying on some person out of the kindness of their heart, which is a lot less likely in 2022 that you're going to find that person.
Yeah. And being able to piece together like the human aspects of investigations with the technology, right? Like technology is only going to get you so far. This has been great, really interesting to kind of try and understand some of these organizations. Anything other things you would want someone who's running a business to understand and think about? Because we so often hear that they're like, well, I'm not really, and this is interesting, but I'm never going to get targeted, right?
Yeah.
What would you say to that person? And
yeah, well, like everything, there was a time when that was true. And I think organizations, mid-sized to small organizations, weren't really targets for major attacks, just for a lot of different reasons. But there is a market for everybody now. So you have these monster organizations like Conti, for example, that are targeting companies that are $100 million or more in annual revenue, right? Because they're the big brand name, they're the major leagues, and they're going to hit these companies and say, we want $20 million, and they know they could pay. That's one of the other things that came out in the leaked documents, was that the amount of time they are spending on researching their victims, so that in the early days, it was like they'd pick a number. It was like you'd have a client and they'd say, we want 10 million. And you're like, the company's like, we don't make that in 5 years. Like, what are you talking about? You know, now it's proportionate to what the company is, because they're doing business research on the company, on their victim. And so there are all these affiliates then fall below. And those affiliates are not going after these huge $3 billion companies. They don't have the resources. They don't have the skills. So there's a pot, a lid for every pot. And so we've handled these ransomware cases for these Fortune 50 companies, and we've handled them for these mom and pop accounting firms and everything in between. And they're sitting there going, this is ridiculous. Like, we have like a small home office in Idaho. Why are we being targeted? Well, because it's $50,000 that they didn't have before, and they sharpen their skills. They hone their skills. They develop their trade craft, and then they move up to a larger company for their next one. So I think because there's so much money in this, that's what people don't realize, is that you're going to be the target of somebody. You're not going to get a demand of 20 million, but a demand of 500,000 might be enough to bankrupt your company. You know, that might be enough to bank. So it's proportionate to your company size.
Yeah. It's franchising.
Right.
And automation.
Exactly.
Right? Just like you see the stuff in the normal world, right? Like, oh, well, they can use our brand and they'll send us. You know, did you see at Conti, like, were they publishing like what their take is and what their rates are for some of their affiliates?
Yeah, it was like 30%, I think it was. I think so. Conti proper gets 30% and the affiliates get the rest. But they get 30% for
franchise model.
Yeah, and they provide, they're not doing a lot. They're providing the infrastructure. They're providing, that was another thing that, you know, they're very good at, is providing the affiliates with kind of the how-to. Like, you don't need to be a master coder to do this. Like, you could basically be a script kiddie. And I just paused there because I think about, thank God this stuff didn't exist when I was a kid, because the temptation of 15-year-old Vinny reading on some forum about making money using ransomware and learning about that. Imagine that temptation for a kid that doesn't understand risk reward and says, hey, you know, I can make $20,000 from my house by just doing blah, 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 and I never have to leave my house. How tempting that might be. But they provide very specific instructions that you don't have to be a computer maven to figure this out. You could be basically someone with pretty basic understanding of how this stuff works, and you could fit into that enterprise in a way that you can make money. So yeah, that's their cut. 30, I think it was 30%, and that's probably pretty standard for most of these organizations. And then you're dialed in just like that. You buy a kit and you're dialed in. Now you're a ransomware threat actor. Crazy.
Yeah, that's bananas. Vinny, this is really fun. I appreciate the time. Would love for you, maybe you can send us a couple of links where people can listen to some more of your chats on this, as well as some of those resources, like if they wanted to read through,
sure,
you know, some of the crazy findings that are coming out of that. That'd be great.
Great.
I look forward to talking with you again. I hope it is not, I have to do it in an emergency. Yeah.
Same.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you, Vinny.
All right. Cool, man. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cyber Crime Lab, brought to you by Datastream Insurance. When the worst happens, you're going to want the best financial, legal, and technical support to get you back up and running again. With cyber insurance from Datastream, we find the most comprehensive insurance coverage on the market, alongside critical post-incident customer support. Go to datastreaminsurance.com today and see how we can help you secure your business data. That's datastreaminsurance.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You'll find show notes and any resources mentioned at cybercrimelabpodcast.com. We hope you'll join us next episode. Until then, stay safe. More importantly, stay ready.